Welcome to Blog Talk Radio in high fidelity.
Welcome to the Along Came a Writer Network. Opinions expressed in our shows do not necessarily reflect those of the network.
It is that time again, Geek Block heads. Put on your treble slippers and settle in for the Geek Block. I'm your host, Carla Hoke. NaNoWriMo November is steadily creeping up on us, and if you don't know what that is, well, stay tuned and all your questions will be answered and all your dreams will come true. In preparation for that event, I wanted to bring on somebody who would more than prepare you to get your 50,000 words on the page. That's the goal of NaNoWriMo. If there is a Jedi Council of Christian speculative fiction, he's on it. He's on it, and he's sitting like in the middle. He's in a good seat. He's the original founder of March of Lord Press, Premier Christian Spec Fic Publishing House, as well as the author or co-author of, every time I counted, I got a different number. So it's somewhere between 15 and 100. I'm going to say 100 and even 100 books. He's one of the finest editors out there. He edits on all levels. And he's my favorite writing teacher. And I'm not just saying that because I have him on the phone. He really is. If he has an online course, I have taken it. And right now, his book, Write Your Novel in a Month, is free for Amazon Prime members. So download it. My guest today is Jedi Jeff Gerke. How are you today, sir?
I'm fine, Carla. Thanks for having me on.
Okay. How many books have you either written solo or written with somebody? Because it's an obscene number. Do you even know?
Yeah, well, it is kind of strange, but it's not 100. No, it's closer to the 15 number. I've done 6 novels under a pen name, and those are now out again under my actual name, but when they were traditionally published, that's how they came out. I've co-written, I think, 2 books, 4 publishing houses. Those were nonfiction. I've written 5 nonfiction books for Writer's Digest on how to write fiction. I've ghostwritten at least 2. I wrote a novel for a client this summer. So, you know, it's closer to 12 to 18, somewhere in there.
Boy, you know what? What it must be like to just not really know how many books you've written. I'm going to just say that you've written 100. We're just going to go with 100. All right. Tell folks how they can find you on the internet.
Well, I'm at jeffgerke.com. So that's the best way to do it. My email address is curiously jeff@jeffgerke.com. Last name is Gerke. You can find me on Amazon. I'm not on Facebook right now. I've been on forever and I'm currently off for 2 months and actually loving it, but you can find me a variety of other ways.
Okay. You are an editor among other things, and I don't think people realize how many levels of editing there are. Give people an idea of the different type of editing processes there are out there. There's line edit, there's copy edit. Give them a quick explanation of what that is.
Yeah, the difficulty is that people use the same words to mean different things and different words to mean the same things. And and so basically there's 2 main categories of editing, and I'll explain those and then I'll go into more detail. But the first category would be what I would just call editing, and that's where you're working with structurally on the manuscript and you're helping the writer kind of perfect the execution of what the writer's trying to say. That's more structural stuff. Then there's something called copy editing, and I would lump proofreading or proofing into that category. And that's more along the lines of somebody comes along and notices that you left off a closed quotation mark in one of your dialogue lines, or that you, you know, changed the name of a character halfway through a book. These are more things like grammar, punctuation, usage, style, anything that might be in that glorious orange book, the Chicago Manual of Style. is the purview of the copy editor. And so it's very possible to be a very good copy editor and not know how to edit at all, and vice versa. It's possible to be a great editor and not be able to copy edit, you know, to the, and that's kind of my situation. I'm a strong editor, but, and I think I'm pretty good with grammar and punctuation, but no copy editor I've worked with has ever said, you know, Jeff, you're going to put me out of a job. They always find something they can fix. So first distinguish between editing and copy editing. Now within editing, there's several subcategories there, and that's where the terminology can get really confusing. Oh, let me also mention there's something called copy editing, which I've talked about, but there's something called copywriting, which is completely different and has nothing to do with copyright. It has to do with writing copy, which is usually marketing, you know, the back cover blurb and the catalog thing and so forth. So that's copywriting, not to be confused with copy editing. So, but then on the straight editing side, there's different levels of intensity and involvement. So I do kind of a 1,000-foot bird's eye view editing service that I call the editorial review. And in that, I'll just read the whole manuscript and I'll create a separate standalone Word document, and I'll give anywhere from 4 to 20 pages of feedback, just, you know, single spaced notes, bulleted notes of what I saw, what's working, what's not working, what was confusing, and so forth. It's not extremely detailed, but it's a great resource, and it's inexpensive because it takes me, you know, only a week as opposed to some of these things that might take me longer. And so then moving into a more intensive level from that is, well, I'll talk about terminology. There's something called substantive editing, sometimes also called content editing, sometimes also called developmental editing. As you might conclude, that people mean different things by that, and that doesn't even include the other one called line editing. So what I've done on jeffgerke.com is I basically say, here's what I'm calling things, and here's a paragraph or three of what I will do for that.
Right.
And the reason I do that the specific reason for me is that I was once hired by a publishing house to do a line edit on a book, on a novel by a well-known author. And I did it. I did a very, very good line edit. And then I got an angry email from the publisher saying they were firing me because I had overlooked some commas.
Oh, dear heavens.
Right. They meant copy edit.
Right.
They said line edit. I gave a line edit, as most people understand it. They wanted copy edit, and so I was fired for doing what they asked for, but not what they thought they were asking for. So there's confusion there that can result in your ability to make money, you know. So the next level beyond editorial review that I offer is a term that I made up. I call it a comprehensive critique, and in that I'm essentially going line by line through your manuscript, writing you know, suggested corrections or changes right in the text with a Word's feature called track changes turned on.
Yes, so my changes, I love track show up. Changes,
shows up in color, and it's very easy to see where I've inserted or rejected something, I mean, or deleted something. And then I also write a ton of margin comments. You know, this was confusing because of this, and I think you need a bridge because of this, and wait a minute, on this page she said she would never do this again, and here she is doing it. I think you need to talk about that, whatever. And it's very comprehensive and intensive. And I'm also,
I think that's
doing
the most important. I do. I think that's the most important edit, because at the end of the day, I can sit down and, now I'm too lazy to do it, I'm just going to go ahead and say, but you can learn how to do punctuation. Okay. It's a hard, fast set of rules, but the kind of stuff that you're talking about right now, boy, that makes all the difference. If you've you've got a great story and yeah, you've messed up on your commas, people are going to overlook that. But, right. You know, you've got to have the great story.
Right. This is where an editor really earns his money.
Yes.
And
right.
So, you know, this is where I'm looking at big picture things. I'm going, you know what, this character is really functioning as, you know, performing the service of this other character. Why don't you combine these two characters? Or, you know, you've kind of lost your yeah. way. Or, you know, you're failing. And this is one I'm unfortunately saying a lot. You're failing to pass the so what test. You know, I've lost track of why I should keep reading. And so, I mean, this is really where a professional reader can come in and give you the objectivity that you've lost. And so that's really terrific. And the way I do it, I'm also polishing the words. I'm fixing punctuation where I see it. If I go, okay, this is, you know, you said today I'm going to go to the store today, you know, I'll knock one of those out and, you know, I'll just try to polish it. And that is essentially a line edit. A line edit goes through and polishes the sentences, not to steal the writer's voice. There's no need to do that and say, oh, you should have written it like this, but more to help the writer better do what it is she's trying to do and say, okay, I know what you mean here, but you know, this isn't clear. This sounds like you're saying he's already finished and he hasn't even started. You know, what about something like this? Whatever. And so by the end of a comprehensive critique, I've essentially done what most people call a developmental edit and a line edit. Mm-hmm. And so really that's about 80%, 75 to 80% of a full edit, you know, a full enchilada edit, which we're not quite at yet. So, you know, when I'm doing a full enchilada edit, it starts with this comprehensive critique / line edit, where I'm going really slowly through the whole manuscript and doing, I mean, it's not unusual for me to write in my comments an additional 10,000 words, 20,000 words of comments for the author. And so then I sent, when I'm doing a full edit, I send that back and the author reads over my notes and my suggested revisions and then decides, you know, which of those he or she is going to do. And, you know, because a lot of times I'll say, you know, I think everything from page 50 on is great, but you're not starting the book in the right place. I'm not engaged. I'm not going to get to page 50 because you haven't engaged me. So, you know, I do a lot of, you know, you better, why don't you think about restarting the book? And here's some suggestions on what to include. And so they'll go off and do that. And then when they send it back to me, if I'm doing a full edit, then I'll do another pass through everything. But it's a quicker pass. It's a lighter pass. And mainly I'm concentrating on the things that the author has changed during revision.
The great thing that this is the best thing for me about NaNoWriMo is it's not edit heavy. It's get the words on the page heavy. Now, explain to folks what NaNoWriMo is.
Well, first, it stands for something. NaNoWriMo stands for National Novel Writing Month. And it's just an optional, fun, hey, we're all doing this, do you want to do it with us kind of activity that writers all over the nation, all over the world, I guess, use as a kind of personal challenge to, you know, sit your rear in the chair and crank out these words, as many words as you can on the novel or screenplay or whatever that you're trying to write. The official goal for the NaNoWriMo month program is 50,000 words or more. It's free, it's fun, and you're right, you just can't put your editor hat on while you're writing. You just have to keep that writer's hat on. Don't worry that it's terrible and, you know, whatever. You can always fix something once it's on the page. Until it's on the page, you have nothing. You just have this blinking cursor saying, loser. Loser, right? So, but once you have a rough draft, you've got a thing and you can start, you know, fixing it. So NaNoWriMo is great for one of those, you know, don't think about it. Don't paralyze yourself. Just go, 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 go. And we'll deal with it later.
there's a phrase writers use called just vomit it out. And that sounds so awful, but you do. You just get it out and just get it on the page. So when November 1 rolls around, somebody says, you know what? I am going to do it. And they sit down at their desk and the cursor is blinking. What do they do? Do they just start writing, or do you have a suggested way of going about it?
Well, I happen to write a book on this topic, Carla.
You do. You did.
I did. Yeah, it's called Write Your Novel in a Month. And,
yes, it is free right now for Amazon Prime, folks. If you're Amazon Prime, download that book. It's fantastic. All right, you may continue.
Thank you. Right. So it's not really ideal to sit down November 1 and say, okay.
No, it is not.
I'm gonna start, because you don't have anything planned out. And, you know, some writers like to write by the seat of their pants, and they don't want to plan anything out. And so for them, that's fine. Most writers need to have some idea of where they're going to go. And it's not cheating. You know, I mean, who cares if it's cheating or not? The whole thing about NaNoWriMo is to get yourself writing pages.
Right.
So, you know, there's no cheating or not cheating as long as you're not plagiarizing. Mm-hmm. But the idea that I use is, okay, let's start from whatever your story idea is, just even if it's a kernel of an idea or a question about a character or something. And then through the book, Write Your Novel in a Month, I give ways to flesh that out and say, okay, well, what kind of genre would you think about for that? And what I do character work that you can do. I do lots of work with Myers-Briggs temperaments on your characters. And, you know, we can develop three-act structure. We can get all this stuff ready, all the things percolating, so that when November 1 happens, you just, now you can sit down and go, because you've laid the tracks and it's all stretched out in front of you. It's all in your head, and you can just go. That doesn't mean that you won't have days when you're sitting around going, okay, how am I going to get this next part done? How am I going to get him from here to here? There's always days where you're thinking and strategizing. But, you know, if you sit down on November 1st and haven't done any of the legwork, then you're going to spend the month doing the legwork. And then on November 30th, you're going to go, okay, I'm ready to go. So it's better to do the work, you know, and if you get the book now, you've got time to do it and be ready November 1st.
Right. And you basically categorize writers into two categories. What are those categories?
I do. Thank you. I think that all novelists are either what I call plot first novelists or character first novelists. And it's usually pretty self-evident what I mean as soon as I say that. Most writers nod their heads. But a character first novelist is somebody who thinks of characters all day long. You know, oh, I wonder what makes this person tick. And, you know, oh, I heard this person say this and it just intrigued me. What would go into somebody saying something like that? What would that person's story be? And those people come up with really brilliant characters and usually beautiful dialogue and just, you know, very rich characters who are differentiated from one another, realistic and all this. And the problem with them is sometimes they kind of don't know what to have these interesting characters do.
Right.
You know, their plot part is usually not as well developed as their character part. And then the plot first novelist is the opposite. You know, that person has story ideas all day long. Oh, the aliens are probably going to come here and they'll steal the cows first, because what they're going to do is, you know, whatever. And you have these story ideas, but your character ideas are usually really weak. You know, they're stereotypes. It's the surfer or the Mexican or, you know, whatever. Or they're stereotypes, or they're all sound like you. They all sound like the author. They're all very shallow. They're interchangeable. You could change you could accidentally mix their names up and no one would know the difference, because they're all the same.
Right.
So, you know, the plot first guy needs character work, and the character first person needs plot work. I happen to write a book on that too. It's called Plot Versus
You
Character.
Do. It's amazing. And folks, if you don't get what we mean by how, you know, they concentrate on one thing and the other thing falls flat, if you've ever gone to a movie and you've left and you just laugh about the characters and the mannerisms and the things, I'm Medea. I think about Medea. Yeah. She is a brilliant character. If you're thinking about characters, you know, it may be because the plot wasn't that tight. Or if you walk away from a movie and you remember the whole story, tell me another person other than Katniss. And people go, fantastic storyline. But sometimes the characters, can fall a little bit flat. You mentioned this. If you're an author, why not just base the main character on yourself? Why do you suggest not doing that? Because it seems so easy. I'll just make them do whatever I would do.
Right. And I mean, essentially, we're all going to do that to some degree.
To some degree, right.
I think the danger in writing yourself as the main character is that each of us behaves in ways that are kind of random and are not really consistent. And the whole, you know, magic of fiction is that we take the complexity of reality and our real world and our real lives, and we kind of boil it down and put a focus on it and a theme on it, and we surface the things that contribute to that theme and focus, and we delete the things that don't. And it becomes kind of a manufactured and artificial view of reality, but it's one that allows us to concentrate on certain aspects. And people are the same way. You know, we've got so many contradictory aspects to ourselves that once you start writing realistically about yourself, as a character, then you as a character start appearing inconsistent, and the reader is going, no, wait a minute, you know, on this page you're like this, and on this page you're totally different. And that may be true because for you as a real human, but for characters, we look for kind of an organizing principle. And so, you know, that's one reason I love the Myers-Briggs temperament stuff. I'm a plot first guy. So characters, you know, they don't make sense to me. You know, I just.
No. Why do we even need characters? Just tell the story.
Right. I mean, as long as the girlfriend.
Yes.
As long as the girlfriend is next to the truck when it blows up, we're all good.
Exactly.
You know, so in order to create realistic people, I needed help. And the Myers-Briggs thing is wonderful because it gives 16 characters, 16 varieties of human. And, you know, you might say, well, that's only 16 people. Well, you know, my characters before were all versions of me. So 16 is a lot better than just one. So, and then if I write a temperament that's from the Myers-Briggs, then I kind of stick with what the book or the website says about that character, especially if I'm not this temperament. Then I rely on the book and things seem more consistent. Whereas if I'm writing myself, or even if I'm writing a character who's my temperament, then I tend to not pay attention to the definition. I tend to kind of go off the rails. And that's when readers can feel like your characters are inconsistent. So we're all going to do it, you know, to some degree. But for your first, you know, a couple of books, your first couple of main characters, I would recommend that you write somebody who's different from you and base it on some kind of definition and parameters like you would find in a temperaments book.
I love the temperament thing too, because you can think, okay, I'm not really sure what my character would do in this position. Well, go look. And if you've never done a Myers-Briggs, the very first letter is either an I or an E, as in introvert or extrovert. That does not mean the person is shy or not shy. I think sometimes people have I first characters and they make them, you know, kind of, they don't talk. They're quite, I'm an extreme introvert. I'm not shy. I think you're a little bit of an introvert. Are you?
Oh, I'm definitely an I, yeah.
Yeah. It's just how you read. This is how I've read it. And I think this is a good explanation. It's not my words. It's how your character refuels themselves. If your character gets charged by being around other people, then they're an extrovert. If they have to get alone, like if we're at a writing convention, Jeff, and I'm around people all day, I'm so tired at the end of the day. I have to get away. I do. I need a sign that says, okay, back away. It's time.
Right.
So know what an introvert and an extrovert is. Okay. You mentioned three act structure. So somebody has got their character down. They know their Myers-Briggs. This is something else you've mentioned. You need to be able to write a page of dialogue and know exactly which character is speaking. That is super smart. Didn't you say that?
I did. Are you going to ask me about three-act structure or what?
Yes.
Which one are you asking me about?
Three-act structure. Go. What is it?
Okay. Well, three-act structure. Okay. So three-act structure is just a way of organizing any story. And even jokes have three-act structure. You have the opening line, you know, guy walks into a bar and And then you have the middle where you're kind of setting everything up, and then you have the punchline where you end it. So novels are the same way. You know, you have set up to, you're introducing characters, you're setting up the situation, you're setting up the plot, you're putting things in motion, but really the heart of your story is what's happening in the middle. It's act two. And so that's, you know, when Indiana Jones is chasing after the Ark. It's when our guys are trying to kill the great white shark. It's where, you know, our heroes are trying to escape the Death Star. This is the heart of the story. It's where the main action happens. Everything, you couldn't do that on page one or the first minute of your movie.
No.
You had all these things you had to set up. So the setup is act one. Act two is the fun and the middle and the heart of your story. And then act three brings it all to a head and then finishes it. That's a quick explanation of three act structure.
And how do you suggest that people just kind of chart that out on a piece of paper?
Well, I do, but you know, you have to find your own way. It's possible to over outline, and it's possible to under outline. And every person has his or her own place on that continuum. I once used to be an uber outliner, and then I realized that you can outline so much that you've actually stolen all the joy out of writing, because you've made all the discoveries, you've had all the fun ideas, and they're all sitting there on a spreadsheet or something, and all that's left is the boring grunt work of writing out long scenes and making these discoveries happen. And you know, so now I don't do that anymore. Now I just kind of get as much as I need to know where I'm going. I'll do three act structure, I'll do that sort of thing, but then I leave a lot of the specifics up to my discovery, and I'll get to a point and go, okay, I need somebody to do this, and I had thought it was going to be this guy, but now I've put him over here and he's in the hospital, you know, but I still need somebody to do it. So I have a balance of where I need to go, but then also allowing the freedom and the discovery of how I'm going to make it happen.
Okay, so you get your 50,000 words on the page. By the way, I looked up some books that are 50,000 words or less. Slaughterhouse-Five, Fahrenheit 451, Great Gatsby, Old Yeller, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and The Outsiders. That just saying that book makes my heart warm. These are all 50,000 words or less, which of course means they were easy to write. No, it doesn't.
You could go even shorter than that and think of massively impactful stories like A Christmas Carol, which is the Scrooge story.
Exactly.
Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. You know,
that's
all of these
right.
are, you know, short stories and so forth. So, there's a lot of goodness that can happen in 50,000 words or fewer.
And it's a shame, because if you go sit down, and this is just me on my soapbox, it's a little one. You sit down in front of a publisher and you say, oh, well, it's 50,000 words. They're going to kind of push it back to you and tell you to fatten it up. But that's just me. I don't think you should have to. When the masterpiece is done, it's done. That's how I feel. Which is why my house is a mess all the time. Okay, when you edit, okay, so you've got your 50,000 words on the page. You're like, okay, now I'm going to edit. How do you keep yourself from rewriting the thing again? I find myself getting in that loop where I'm just rewriting chapter one 10 times. Do you suggest, hey, if you want to keep writing it, keep going? Or do you say, okay, enough is enough?
Well, again, every writer is going to be different. You have to find a place that is not dysfunctional for yourself. But, you know, so I guess that's the end of that sentence. You have to find a place that's not dysfunctional. So if you're rewriting because you're like, you've got these existential fears of your own self-worth and things like that, and you're afraid of what people are going to think of you, and then you're going to rewrite and rewrite for wrong reasons. You know, and at that point, I would just, you know, let the rough draft go. But other people find that they haven't really hit their stride. I have a novelist friend who writes her books three times over every time. And that would just drive me insane. You know, the way I do it is I just write it once. I tend to start one day's writing by looking over yesterday's writing, the previous day's writing, and doing a little bit of a polish, and also to get me back in that headspace. But I don't typically do major rewrites. What I'll do is, once I'm going through, I'll start realizing that I need to go back and fix some things, but I don't want to do it now. I want to go ahead and finish the thing. So by the end, I've got this list created that I've just put on another Word document of, you know, 9 things that I need to go back and do. And I'll go back and do those. And when I've done them, you know, after I've hit the end, I'll go back to the rough draft and do those nine things. And when I've done those, I will maybe read the opening paragraph or opening chapter again just to do a quick polish. But by, you know, the end of that process, my first draft, I consider it done and I'm ready to show it.
You know, Kathy Tyers, I'm pretty sure she said she writes all of her books about six or seven times, for real.
Yeah.
And she's awesome and she's perfect in every way. Okay, here's another thing that I see people running into, and I know I've run into this as well. What do you do when you realize you have too much dialogue? How do you convert that dialogue to what is the opposite of dialogue? What would you say? What is the opposite of that? But do you know what I mean?
Where you No, I would say I've never seen a novel that had too much dialogue.
Really?
Dialogue. Yeah, I mean,
that doesn't bother you. It doesn't bother you when there's just dialogue after dialogue. That doesn't bother you as a reader?
No, I mean, okay. I did read a Writer's Digest craft book years and years ago on dialogue that was written as a dialogue. The entire thing was spoken word, and it was absolutely exhausting. And so, yes, I know it's possible to do that. I don't think I've ever encountered one where I thought there was too much dialogue. Usually authors err on the side of too much summary, and I'm always telling them to break it into a dialogue scene to make this information come out in a realistic way. And if you think about screenplays, they are all dialogue in terms of what the writer actually writes. Everything else is little, almost parenthetical comments about, you know, who's there and where they are and what they're wearing. But the focus is on the dialogue. So, but I guess if you felt like you had too much dialogue and other people were feeling like it was tiresome, then I don't know, maybe insert more beats. Beats are text that kind of describe the location and describe what the actors, the characters are doing on stage, go into some more internal monologue of thoughts, cut away to pure description moments. But no, I would be curious to see a book that had too much dialogue.
Well, I'm not going to change it. You said my dialogue was fine, and so I'm going to leave it. But, you know, you mentioned something a minute ago where people do summaries and they say what people are wearing, all that kind of stuff. That is showing versus telling, and that's a problem. Tell the difference at showing and telling.
Showing and telling. Well, different people have different definitions. Mine has the distinctiveness of being easy to understand, so you can go with my definition.
Yes, I do.
Telling is when you simply say on the page, John was a jerk.
Right.
You know, that really has no impact on the reader. The reader's like, well, whatever, you know, it has no impact. But if you show John coming home and, you know, tromping his muddy boots across the white carpet and, you know, kicking the dog, and the toddler comes running toward him, daddy, daddy, and he palms the kid on the head and knocks him on his diapers and, you know, sits down on the couch, turns on the NASCAR game and sticks his boots up on the coffee table and says, "Woman, where's my beer?" Then the reader feels it. And the reader's like, "Man, John was a jerk." Right. And that's the difference between showing and or between telling and showing. Showing makes you feel it. Telling makes you not feel it. And telling is very accurate and very concise. And you can explain a person's entire backstory in a paragraph, but you've stopped the story. Nothing interesting is happening on stage and you're boring your reader. Whereas it takes more words and it's a broader brush to show those things, to illustrate them, to act them out. But they're much more impactful on the reader. And so I mean, I'm kind of a purist when it comes to show versus tell. I'm almost no telling and I'm all showing. So, but that's just me. And again, you have to find your place, and readers don't mind as much as those of us who, you know, study this stuff. And so,
if you're
self-publishing, maybe you don't worry about it as much.
But, you know, at the end of the day, if you follow the one hard and fast rule, keep the reader turning the pages, keep the reader interested. You know, there are people that break these rules. And I think of Gone Girl. Gone Girl is told, you read excerpts from her diary. So she's telling, and the whole time I was reading the book, I'm like, she's telling. But boy, I kept turning the pages. So if you are going to break those, keep going.
Well, my way of saying, you know, keep the reader engaged. That's the positive way of saying it. Keep your reader engaged from beginning to end. My negative way of saying it is don't be boring.
Right. And, you know, showing versus telling. When I taught, I would hear my students, you know, cussing in the hallway. And I came in one day and I said, look, you don't understand. You're not telling me very much when you say that she's the son of a you-know-what, because your idea of that is going to be different than my idea of that. You know, you saying somebody's a jerk, you have a different vision than what I see. So when you get more specific about what they're doing, it tells you, okay, this is the kind of jerk I'm talking about.
Yeah, right,
so
the
that,
flavor.
That's, right, this particular flavor. Okay, are you okay going about 8 more minutes? Are you okay with that? Are you all right on time? Okay,
sure.
Great. Okay, last but not least, when you are going back through your 50,000 words, be sure you are good and tight on your point of view. Explain to folks what a point of view is. You don't have to tell all the different types, just in a nutshell.
No.
Just in a nutshell,
that's
what is
fine.
It?
Modern fiction is told through the eyes of a viewpoint character. I call it picking a head. You pick a head, you get inside the head of one character in your scene, and you see the scene through that person's eyes. And so as a reader, we have access to that one person's thoughts, memories, and senses, you know, what he or she sees, hears, tastes, whatever. And so I picture it as people writing in a submarine that has no windows or no monitors. And there's a story going on above the surface of the ocean. And the only way that those people down there are going to find out what's going on is to use a periscope, to stick the periscope up, and the periscope looks around and sees what's happening. And that's a viewpoint character. That's we're in that head. We can only see what the periscope can see. For instance, we can't see that the sun is reflecting off the lens of the periscope. Periscope can't see itself. And so, you know, we're restricted to what we can gain by looking through that periscope lens. So, you know, you pick a head in a scene and you give us that periscope's view, and you can, you know, change the scene and change your viewpoint characters. But it's not usually done in modern fiction to be able to jump around into multiple people's heads in the middle of a scene. You know, we learn what Jimmy feels, and we learn what Jenny feels, and we learn what Mary feels and what they're all thinking. And that's called omniscient point of view. And it was done with Dickens and, you know, the classics,
but it's
not typically done in modern fiction.
I have a problem when you know the point of view and this person walks into the room and they know names of people they've never been introduced to. I would think that is slipping out. So go ahead.
That's a point of view error. That's right. There's no
way
that person could know. Well, and it's so hard because it's a discipline for the writer, because the writer knows everybody's names and the reader might even know you know, who that person is, but the character doesn't know. And so you have to restrict yourself to what that person knows.
Right. Exactly. Oh, okay. Well, she is just about up. Okay. Tell us, again, where we can find you online.
Okay. JeffGerke.com.
JeffGerke.com. And to prepare for NaNoWriMo, what is a great book for them to buy, Jeff, or get it free on Amazon Prime?
That's right. Write your novel in a month. It's a writer's
digest
book.
It really is a fantastic book. For real, it really is a great book. Okay, are you ready for some rapid fire questions?
I am.
Okay, worst to sit next to on a transcontinental flight, Trump, Clinton, or Jar Jar Binks?
Oh, I like Jar Jar.
I hate him. You know how much I hate him.
Well, you asked. oh my goodness. I think all three of those would be fascinating. I mean, and it's funny, Jar Jar does kind of rank at the same level of interestingness with those others.
But you know,
no, I would be happy with any of them.
Okay, all right. Well, you know what? people have pitched a fit about Hillary Clinton, and I'm not saying who I'm voting for here, how she called Trump supporters a basket of deplorables. As a writer, I have laughed my head off at that. That is such a clever line. I wish I had.
Isn't it a great
line.
Word picture?
It's a great line. Okay.
It is.
Star Wars, The Force Awakens, yes or no? That's the most recent one.
Yes, I knew that.
Yes, I say yes,
a qualified yes, but yes, because I think it's setting up some real fun things we can do now that they did this handoff and bridge. So yeah, I like it. I mean, it's probably like fourth favorite out of the seven.
Me too. For me, I thought the same thing. Folks, if you don't know, Jeff has a background in film. That's why I tend to ask him film questions. Okay, Yoda puppet or CGI?
You know, I just finished watching a documentary on episode 2 where they did the very first fully 3D CGI Yoda, including the fighting and so forth. And it's funny, they realized that they could make Yoda too perfect and it didn't look right. So they made him as a CGI character more like a puppet so that he looked right. They did the shaking of the ears and they did the movement of the hand, the movement of the hand within the head and everything.
Uh-huh.
So I like Yoda as a CGI character done as a puppet.
Done as a puppet. So I'm going to say puppet. I'm going to say puppet. Okay. Worst neighbors, orcs, zombies, or the apes from Planet of the Apes?
Oh, wow.
It's a condescending bunch of apes. That's a tough one. They are really apes that make you feel stupid.
No, well, I think I would pick apes above the other two because the other two are probably going to eat you.
I'd rather feel stupid every day than dead.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay, last but not least, worst superpower, superhuman strength only when dressed as a woman, or the ability, I gotta laugh thinking about you dressed as a woman, or the ability to stop criminals only by spraying them like a skunk.
Well, is this for me? I mean, because a female
you personally
would love to be dressed. Yeah, the spraying would be kind of awkward. You have to run up and like
Jeff,
run back.
Oh, Jeff, I see you in a prairie dress.
I've done a mock book cover of me as an Amish woman. So
I think you would rock the Amish look.
Yeah. So
So we're going dressed as a woman.
Okay.
Okay, that's the best one, but the worst one is spraying like a skunk. I think you have to have a special kind of outfit for that situation. That's a deli. Okay, that is it for you, sir. You are off the hook with me, I promise. Thank you for joining us today. Hands down, you're one of my favorite guests. Thank you so much,
thanks,
Jeff.
Carla. Very much fun.
You are dismissed, good sir. That's it for us on the Geek Block. I'm your host, Carla Hope. Check out my blog on Fight Right, FIGHTWRITE.net. And if you'd like to contract me to critique your fight scenes, contact me through Fight Right or through Quill Pen Editorial, easy for you to say, quillpeneditorial.com. That is it. Tune in next month. And folks, get ready for NaNoWriMo. Now is the time to prepare. Get Write Your Novel in a Month, free on Amazon Prime, and get ready so that November 1, you are ready to bust it. That's it for me. Have a blessed day and stay weird.